Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for being here. Good to see you all. I'm going to start right away with a poem by Mary Oliver. It's called The Buddha's Last Instruction. Make of yourself a light, said the Buddha before he died. I think of this every morning as the east begins to tear off its many clouds of darkness to send up the first signal, a white sand streak with pink and violet, even green. An old man, he lay down between two sala trees, and he might have said anything, knowing it was his final hour. The light burns upward. It thickens and settles over the fields. Around him the villagers gathered and stretched forward to listen. Even before the sun itself hangs, disattached in the blue air, I am touched everywhere by its ocean of yellow waves. No doubt he thought of everything that had happened in his difficult life. And then I feel the sun itself as it blazes over the hills, like a million flowers on fire. Clearly I'm not needed, yet I feel myself turning into something of inexplicable value. Slowly beneath the branches, he raised his head. He looked into the faces of that frightened crowd. So, this morning I want to give a talk on a couple of teachings of Katagiri Roshi's from Each Moment is the Universe. And today is the 25th anniversary of Katagiri Roshi's death. So we had a service yesterday, which is a traditional thing to do, a founder's memorial service. And so today I want to touch on some of these teachings that were really key to his Dharma. And the teachings are on time and impermanence and the way-seeking mind. And I have to say, Each Moment is the Universe is a lot about impermanence. And it's a commentary on Dogen's Uji, or being time. And that's a really difficult teaching. As Katagiri said himself, it really gives you a headache. It really gives you a headache, but it's really important teaching to understand both in life, in our bodies and minds, and in theory. So this is going to be a very basic introduction to it, and just talk about a little bit of it. So Katagiri's death was a great teaching. It was a hard teaching, but it was a great teaching of impermanence. At the time of his dying, when he was upstairs in this place, he lived upstairs, he was surrounded by his closest disciples, his ordained students, and they were the only ones allowed to really be close to him at that time. But his lay students felt very close to him. I felt very close to him. So I felt excluded at the time. You know, it didn't feel good because I felt very close to Katagiri Roshi. So one of my friends, who was a formal disciple, they would take turns on the watch by his bedside, called me up and said, I think it's getting close. Would you like to come over? And I said, yes. So I came over and I sat by his bedside, and he was unconscious at that time, but still working really diligently on his dying process.
He just looked like he was working very hard and very diligently and very ardently to do what he had to do. And I felt completely inadequate to the situation. I had no idea what to do. There was nothing I could do. But I felt very inadequate. That's how we feel sometimes. Life and death, just feel like a little inadequate in the face of it. So the great matter of birth and death and impermanence is a great teaching in Zen. And on this wooden han that we have in the up on the top of the stairs, it says something like this on that han. Great is the matter of birth and death. All is impermanent, quickly passing. Be awake each moment. Don't waste this precious life. It's on the hans everywhere. So, and when you hear the han hit twice, you know it's time to get to your cushion. Right? So, the han is really about time. Temporal time. So here's what Dogen says, quoting Nagarjuna in his teaching Points to Watch for Training. The mind that fully sees into the uncertain world of birth and death is called the thought of enlightenment, bodhicitta, or the way-seeking mind. Thus, if we maintain this mind can become the thought of enlightenment. Indeed, when you understand discontinuity or impermanence, the notion of a self does not come into being. Ideas of name and gain do not arise. Fearing the swift passage of sunlight, practice the way as though saving your head from fire. Practice the way as though saving your head from fire. I don't know if I practice like that very often, but I do remember one time when I practiced like that many years ago, and I'll tell a story about that. We were doing a session, it was the late 70s sometime, here, it was a summer session, and we got the news that our dear friend, and I'm going to use actual names because all these stories are written down and you could read them anywhere. We got the news that our dear friend Nancy's son Chris had been killed during this session. Chris was young, like we were. No, he was in his early 20s, and he was killed on the street by a stranger in San Francisco. And as you can imagine, that was a deep shock to everyone, because we all knew Nancy and we knew Chris, and have memories of Chris sitting so straight, just like Katagiri Roshi sat in this sendo. One time he actually fell asleep and fell over. He sat so straight. He went, boom, and we all jumped. That's what happens when you have good full lotus. You can just fall asleep during zazen and end up injured. Anyway, so I was sitting there, and when I got that news, I really started sitting like my hair was on fire. I really felt the preciousness of life and the opportunity to sit and do this practice, a great opportunity, and I wanted to be fully engaged. So I really felt like I sat with my hair on fire. And then I felt this tap on my shoulder, and someone asked me to come out to the kitchen. And at that time, I worked for the Zen Cafe called the Blue Heron Cafe, like many people, like Natalie Goldberg and... Oh, there was a lot of us that worked at the Blue Heron Cafe, which was Nancy's creative child. And so I was told that I should call Martin, Nancy's husband, and he needed to talk to me. So I called him up, and he asked me if I would leave the session and go to work in the cafe that they had a need for someone, and that Nancy couldn't do it, obviously, and would I go? And I said, of course, I'll go, of course. And then he said, but first, stop by and see Nancy. She really needs to talk to you. And then my heart sank, because I thought, oh, what can I say? You know, my mother has just lost her child, and I have to go see her. And I felt really, really inadequate in that situation. And so I, you know, walked slowly to their house on the way to the cafe, and I knocked on the door, and Nancy came out from the back room. I got a big hug from Martin, and it was just terrible, terrible grief. And I said something really stupid that I remember to this day, which I'm not going to tell you. I said something, some platitude about death, something I heard from Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, and Nancy said, but how does she know? How does she know? And there was nothing I could say. There was nothing I could say to that. You know. So that was a big teaching of impermanence. And when I was here in the early 70s, there was a lot of teachings about impermanence and illness. There were people that I knew well that died of cancer who were young. And so for some reason in our sangha at that time, there were many opportunities to experience the swift passing of life and death and impermanence. So Dogen, in Merits of the Monastic Life, and we kind of do a monastic practice here, you know. This is, we are the bhikkhus here. We are the monks. Although we live in the world, we do a very serious practice here. It's more like a monastic practice in Japan. Dogen says that most people are not able to acquire the way-seeking mind without fully understanding that a day consists of 6,400,099,180 moments. So, Katagiri says in each moment is the universe. That he doesn't know where Dogen got that number, but the main point for him and for us is that time is moving at a speed that we can't comprehend. In the 1970s, in his talks, Katagiri Roshi used to say that modern life was moving at a dizzying rate, a really fast tempo that results in our feeling a gap between ourselves and time, like we can never catch up. It's moving too fast, moving too fast. So what do you think? Has that gotten better? Does it feel very different than that to you now? We have all, has technology saved us a lot of time and improved our lives greatly, brought us enlightenment, peace of mind? So we suffer because of the gap between us and time. We feel like there's never enough time, like we're under time pressure, that we can't keep up with the changes. And that gap's really, through the concept of time, that gap is really about the Four Noble Truths. That we feel this deep dissatisfaction, and that deep dissatisfaction is caused by desire or craving. And in the case of time, we desire to escape the gap between us and time. So, you know, in modern life, we often look for something short-term, you know, short-term gratification. You seek to live for pleasure and comfort. And, right? Don't you think so? I do. I see myself doing that all the time. So there is a way out of this suffering and dissatisfaction, and that way is the Eightfold Path. The Eightfold Path. Because every time we indulge in that pattern of turning away from our experience, looking directly at what's happening right now, trying to understand time and impermanence in life, and we turn away from it, we just increase that. We give that pattern more energy of looking away, turning away. Let's see. I'm missing a page. Oh no! That whole page is gone. Wow, that's a good practice for me. To get by without page 4. What can I do? It's gone. It's really impermanent. Oh, but there was another good quote of Dogen's on there.
Make it up.
I'll give you the short version, the cliff notes of that Dogen quote from Uchi, and that is that we, our problem is that we see time only as passing. We see it just as passing. So, and the thing about that is that time is more than just passing. That, of course, we live in time. We live in the 12 hours of the day. We live in linear time, right? Of course we do. But there's also another element, according to Dogen, of time. There are two elements of time working simultaneously. There's eternal time, what Katagiri calls eternal time, and there is temporal time. And that we exist right at the intersection of space and time. Space meaning eternal time, and time, in this case, temporal time, is what Dogen refers to as being time. Being time. In Uji, or the time being. So, because all moments, according to Dogen, there's a little piece of Dogen's quote on page 5 here. He says, in essence, all things in the entire world are linked with one another as moments. Because all moments are the time being, they are your time being. They are our time being. So actually, we are time itself. It's kind of hard to get your mind around that, right? Wrap your mind around that. According to Katagiri Roshi, within each moment is emptiness and dependent co-origination, and that when we act, when we move to act, we are actually acting from what he called the pivot of nothingness. And how do we connect with the pivot of nothingness or emptiness? That is zazen, sitting practice, becoming still, becoming one with everything, all beings, which are included in our activity. So that's the way to understand this difficult problem of time. It's understanding that in daily life, it means completely becoming one with your action. So that's why Dogen Zenji always emphasized the importance of daily activity, like relating with the carrots in the kitchen, using the toilet, Simple things. Kadagiri used to talk about taking good care of the toilet paper. That's why we always emphasize this in Zen, because that is the manifestation of being time. That is how we can not be oppressed by time as well, is by becoming completely one with our activity, completely one, completely, wholeheartedly one with whatever we're doing in daily life. That's true freedom, and that's manifesting being time. And within that is always eternal time, but we can't see it. We're easily distracted by the dizzying pace of our lives. So we have to come back to Zazen and experience that deep peace, which is possible. And I do experience some of that when I sit down here. It's definitely our birthright to do that. So I think as human beings, we are frightened of aging, we're frightened of dying, we're frightened of sick people. And therefore, especially in Western culture, we segregate them so that we don't have to see them. Maybe I'm making a grand sweeping generalization here, but that's what I've noticed, is that we're frightened of it, so we keep it at a distance. And actually, we cheat ourselves when we do that. We cheat ourselves out of our full humanity. What's possible for us, you know, as human beings. We do it out of loneliness. We don't mean to be cruel. We don't mean to inflict suffering or more loneliness on people who are already very lonely. But we do that out of our own sense of aloneness and separation, our own loneliness. So it's kind of an unintended side effect of our freedom-loving, individualistic society, I think. And what does that have to do with the time being? I think that denying our full humanity makes it harder for us to understand the impermanent and empty nature of reality, of our own life. So Katagiri Roshi used to say, just look at your life without blinking. Just look at your life without blinking. So that's another way of saying, don't turn away. Just be present with whatever life is bringing, which isn't easy. It's not easy, but when we do it, we see that although we're alone, also we're completely interconnected, interpenetrated with all beings everywhere. Trees, grasses, walls, fences, each other. So that's the dual, that's the paradoxical nature of our existence, is that we're completely alone and we're completely interpenetrated, interconnected. I think a lot of people are waking up to the fact that our Earth is, that we are completely dependent on our Earth, right? And that the Earth is suffering from the effects of our collective actions and our individual actions as human beings. But we're just like a baby and its mother with the Earth, you know? We're the air, the water, Earth and fire, all those elements. Like we're connected through an invisible, or not invisible, a very, very tangible umbilical cord to the Earth. And so we can see interconnection, interpenetration. We can see emptiness through the situation with our planet. We can see that. Also, the internet helps us as much as it complicates things. It also really helps us to see how connected we are to beings all over the planet, how their fates are connected to our fate. So through Zazen, we can engage in the timeless aspect of practice, and through wholehearted action in everyday life, we can engage in being time, in the temporal aspect. I want to read, speaking of wholehearted presence, wholehearted engagement, the thing that was the biggest teaching for me of Katagiri Roshi was his presence. He was the most present person that I've ever met in my life, and I've never met anyone since that was that present, that here, that now. I think a number of my friends have met Thich Nhat Hanh, and I think Tim has met some other wonderful present teachers, but for me, I have never met anyone who is as present as Katagiri Roshi. And I want to read you this little segment because it illustrates it better than I can, from Natalie Goldberg's book, Long Quiet Highway. She says, "I remember one Saturday afternoon I was sweeping in the kitchen. It was late March, gray, a bit windy, always cold, but bearable now. Winter's back had been broken. You could stand outside and your face wouldn't freeze off." Can you relate? The phone rang. It was Pam. She was already 20 minutes late to pick up Roshi to drive him to the airport. She called to say she'd be another 10 minutes. "Oh my God," I thought. "He'll miss his plane." I frantically went looking for him. He was standing outside by the curb next to a valise. It was not a suitcase, modern, with zippers and nylon. It was a valise, square, gold-colored, with latches. Roshi just stood there in his black robes, as though he had no idea Pam was late. He stood, not waiting, not impatient, just standing. I ran to him. "Roshi," I called. "Pam will be another 10 minutes. My hands were thrown up in the air. I was probably shrieking. He nodded, unperturbed. "Thank you." Just continued to stand. He wasn't waiting. He wasn't coming. He wasn't going. I walked back up the walkway, broom in hand. Several times I looked back over my shoulder. He was still standing there, green army jacket over his black priest robes. That presence, that being present, stunned me. My whole body relaxed. It seemed much more important than making the plane. Pam was going to get there when she got there. Meanwhile, he was standing. I became quiet as I returned to sweep the kitchen. Until I saw that kind of equanimity, I didn't know it was possible. Nothing before in my American world had expressed it. I remember thinking it's actually okay not to get frantic, to allow things to be. I'd scrunch up my face. "Nah," I'd say. "The world can't run that way. He's an anomaly." But I wanted to be around it. My whole heart yearned for it. I was seeing something I couldn't express that actually wasn't very interesting to talk about. I'd try to explain. "Well, I saw him standing outside," I'd tell a friend. "Yeah," my friend would reply. "He was standing," I'd say. "What was he doing while he was standing?" "Nothing." "Nothing?" My friend would scratch his ear. "So?" "Like so," I'd try to stand as Roshi stood. "So what?" my friend would ask. I didn't know what. I just went over to Zen Center. It wasn't explainable. So nothing hits the mark. Often when we try to explain things through words. And but we can see it. We can see it in the action of a dancer or a ball player. We can see that just motion, that dropped off body and mind, that has to happen because in order to manifest something so presently, one has to get out of one's own way, right? Get out of one's own way. There's no room for the self. So time passes so quickly, we can't see it. We might get a taste of it when we slow down in retreat and we watch our minds. We might be able to see the birth of a thought. We might be able to stay with the thought. Over time, we might be able to do this. Might be able to see how a thought is born and then maintains and then dies. And that's how we can get in touch with time and impermanence. Though time is going very, very fast, Katagiri Roshi used to say, at super speed, in order to get in touch with it, we actually have to slow down. We have to slow way down in order to actually see it. So by sitting in dynamic stillness in a retreat or at home, we can see impermanence through our own body and mind. He also says, we're just completely here at the intersection of time and space, and all we have to do is to harmonize ourselves with that. That's all we have to do. And when we realize how we're interconnected with everything and everyone in a way that we can't see with our ordinary consciousness, that's the beginning of spiritual life. That's the beginning of connecting to eternal time while acting in temporal time. So your quote on your program talks about a peaceful life, and Katagiri Roshi often talked about a peaceful life, a peaceful Sangha life. And a peaceful Sangha life and a way-seeking mind is a result of really seeing time in our lives and the way it functions, really seeing impermanence and the way it functions. Because it's only by seeing that, really getting a taste of that, that we are willing to arouse the mind of bodhicitta, allow that to arise, that we're willing to do this difficult practice of looking directly at our lives without blinking, day after day, year after year, forever. It takes that understanding to be willing to do that. So we can really feel gratitude for this. I feel a lot of gratitude for this practice. I feel a lot of gratitude for this teaching and for the Sangha, because you all act as mirrors for me. So you all give me feedback. Without saying, hey, can I give you some feedback? I don't always like to hear that. But just by practicing here, just by being open, just by being present, you are constantly giving me feedback. And you're getting feedback because we mirror for each other. So if somebody does something really unskillful, something really irritating, we can just sit with that. We can figure out how we might be able to help that person, or we can let them be. We can let them be, because eventually they'll figure something out for themselves. Or, on the other hand, we might see a friend of ours become their practice just bloom and mature. And that's also a great mirror for us. We can feel a lot of encouragement from that, rather than jealousy. Just feel like, wow, that's possible for me too. And that benefits me, that benefits all of us. So gratitude and flexibility are really important for this practice in order to keep going. And a warm feeling towards each other. understanding that we're connected in ways we can't see with our ordinary consciousness. Just coming back to sitting down, being alone together. So that's, you know, that's a very basic and kind of rough, I think, explanation of time and being eternal time and temporal time, impermanence and dependent core arising, how together all of those elements mix together in our practice. In our formal practice, in our day-to-day practice. And just to honor our teacher, our founder, Katagiri Roshi, I'd like to read to you, to end this talk, I'd like to read to you some words that were written for his third year memorial service in 1992 by Dokai Georgeson, my Dharma mentor, Dharma brother. And here it is. The Buddha Dharma neither comes nor goes. The blade cuts both halves into one. The body cheerfully plays with birth and death, sitting peacefully in the lotus of the entire ocean. Respectfully thinking of Jikai Dainin Daiyosho, coming you touched as the sun opens the earth in spring. Without a single word you sat firm through the shaking of a violent storm until the arriving at a far and remote place. You came from the Orient and stayed for 25 years. Yet I ask even now, where was your true home? You lived in the ground among the dark roots and fed the stems into the fresh spring air. You flew to the heavens and played with the small yellow birds and glided as an eagle that cut with its razor beak so sharp the wound would not bleed for a long time. And going, like Vimal, in sickness, you opened your room for all to enter. When asked which direction we should follow, you deftly climbed the summit peak and pointed north, south, east, and west. You waited with great patience until your last days to wield your inexhaustible Dharma shouts. How ordinary. You whispered the story of that exalted monk whose last words were, "I don't want to die." The whole body slipping into the quiet night, I want to ask one more time, where is returning to silence? Ah, yes, good friend. Not for one moment did you ever come, nor for all eternity will you ever go. Thank you. I'm like my first teacher in two ways. I'm serious. And I'm fun-loving, really. And in another way, we both like to play with kids. I can't see the clock, so I don't know how much time we have, Eric, but I think if you would like to say anything or ask something, that's it. Probably a little bit of time for that. Stephanie.
Yeah. I I need to apologize first for my question. I mean that. So, eternal time and being time, and how you have described it, are actually not accessible to me. But I have a crutch. Maybe you know it, and maybe you can tell me if it's a crutch that is helpful. And that is from, it comes from science. It's the idea of the law of the conservation of matter and energy. They are here. They do not go away, and they can't be created either. Right? And what you've described and as being time is the realization that that is what we're all made of, not just we sitting here, everything. And so we are assembled into that, sometimes as humans, sometimes as toilet paper. Now we're humans, and this idea of consciousness is maybe that being time, that we don't know if the toilet paper has consciousness. But, and that might seem like a ridiculous question, but, you know, maybe it isn't so ridiculous. But as the being time, so therefore is a little bit of a limited view of what else is going on. But we know we're being. But the relationship that to everything is so boundless, because we are just the same in the end. And that's maybe how I can understand what you said. But I feel that it's... I apologize because I don't want to plant wrong seeds in the minds of everyone who has to listen to what I'm just coming up with. That was actually really the wrong direction.
I appreciate your apology, and I also apologize. You know, I think that, you know, Zen's always talking about the myriad grasses. So, you know, each of us exists independently. We each hold a Dharma position, right? That's how Dogen would describe that. We each hold a Dharma position, and yet we're completely connected and interconnected, interpenetrating, penetrated in a way that, as you said, is boundless. It's so boundless that we can't see. We can't pull out causes and conditions. They're so interwoven, interconnected. It's very difficult for us to be able to. That's why simplistic explanations of karma don't work, because it's a lot more vast and unknowable by our ordinary conscious minds. It doesn't mean we shouldn't try. We have to keep trying. And, you know, I don't have a background in math or science, so I couldn't speak to that. But I kind of get this at an experiential and intuitive level. I feel that I occupy time and space right here. And yet, I'm empty. Right? Both are true. And my life goes on. It goes on, it goes on. It never stops for me to figure it out. It keeps moving. It's simple. It's nothing but motion and process. Motion and process. And yet, as Dokai says in this poem, there's no coming, no going. Nothing is born and nothing dies. So that living that paradox, living into that mystery, is quite an adventure for us, don't you think? Mm-hmm. It's quite an adventure. We can see how small we are in the vast universe, like the sand in the Ganges River, or Lake Calhoun Beach, at least. You know, we're just, in a sense, we're really birth and death. It's all right here.
and we're at the center of our universe. At the same time, we're very, very, very small. It's good to know that. I don't know if that's helpful to you. And I really don't even know what your question was. I thought you gave a good little mini lecture there.
I think going off of the nothing is born and nothing dies, and the impermanence of everything is, all of us growing up was taught that there are 9 planets in the solar system. There's 9 planets. That's a scientific fact, and science is always right. Always. But then just recently, somehow Pluto isn't a planet. NASA's like, oh, actually, it's not a planet, it's like a moon. So that whole thing we all are ingrained in, science, was wrong, and it's just a little mistake. But all of us getting ingrained in having to believe that 9 planets is the way it is, if not 10, if not 4, there's 9, and then out of nowhere, nope, 8, sorry. I think it just kind of shows that, like, one, science is curiosity at best, because it's just one man trying to trump someone else's thoughts and be like, wait, nope, it's this. And someone else is going to come later on and be like, actually, no, it's this. And everyone's going to believe it. And I think so is consciousness and understanding our way, because it's just what we can comprehend in our human monkey minds and bodies. So I think that kind of gives a principle.
I think what you just said about, you know, science is just one person trumping another, that's also true of religion and philosophy. That's true of human beings. What we do with our system. Kind of Gary said, he said, well, I really do believe in rebirth, but he said, I don't cling to that belief. That's an important point. Sure.
Science doesn't make previous theories wrong. It just, the new theories are more right. Science is always an approximation.
Mm-hmm.
When Einstein came up with his theories, it didn't make Newton wrong. Newton's theories still work. But what Einstein said, they only work up to a point. But Einstein's theories are more right.
It's a really good point.
It's true about religion, too.
Yeah.
I don't know about more right. They provide us more interesting ideas and more areas to investigate, perhaps. Right?
Oh.
I think so often we forget that theories and science are based on a perception, and a perception is very limited. I mean, we can't say necessarily that this is the only perception that exists. And I think it's very tied up in our humanity to measure based on the world, but
you're referring to the rebirth. In Hinduism, we say that if a person desires that he doesn't want a rebirth, he will attain nirvana.
He will what?
He will attain the nirvana state.
Oh, he'll attain nirvana if he doesn't want to.
Rebirth. But if the desire still exists in the person, he may again get to a rebirth, and that process will go for like seven cycles, 7500 cycles.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the teaching on karma and rebirth in Buddhism comes from Hinduism, actually. Yeah. Thank you.
As a scientist, the first thing you learn is that you rarely have proof anything. People talk about what people believe, not proof of the planet. You understand what the definition of what people decide is what planet Pluto is what Pluto is. It doesn't matter what you call it, planet or not. Yes, why not? Big fraction of all the other ones.
That's exactly right. Pluto doesn't care what it is. Pluto doesn't care that its name is Pluto.
It was never made billions of years before he went
home. Thank you. Okay, I think that we should quit now. Really a lot of fun, though.